Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do some stories from Hector Hugh Munroe from The Complete Stories of Saki. We'll do four as usual. We'll begin with his short story called Hyacinth. Like the flower, Hyacinth. The new fashion of introducing the candidate's children into an election contest is a pretty one, said Mrs. Pan Strepon. It takes away something from the acerbity of party warfare, and it makes an interesting experience for the children to look back on in after years. Still, if you will listen to my advice, Matilda, you will not take Hyacinth with you down to Loughbridge on election day. Not take Hyacinth, exclaimed his mother. Hyacinth would be a boy. That's odd to me. But why not? Jutterly is bringing his three children, and they are going to drive a pair of Nubian donkeys about the town to emphasize the fact that their father has been appointed colonial secretary. We are making the demand for a strong navy, a special feature in our campaign, and it will be particularly appropriate to have Hyacinth dressed in his sailor suit. He'll look heavenly. The question is not how he'll look, but how he'll behave. He's a delightful child, of course, but there is a strain of unbridled pugnacity in him that breaks out at times in a really alarming fashion. You may have forgotten the affair of the little Gaffin children. I haven't. I was in India at the time, and I've only a vague recollection of what happened. He was very naughty, I know. He was in his goat carriage and met the Gaffins in their perambulator, and he drove the goat full tilt at them and sent the perambulator spinning. Little Jackie Gaffin was pinned down under the wreckage, and while the nurse had her hands full with the goat, Hyacinth was laying into Jackie's legs with his belt like a small fury. I'm not defending him, said Matilda, but they must have done something to annoy him. Nothing intentionally, but someone had unfortunately told him that they were half French. Their mother was a Duboc, you know. And he had been having a history lesson that morning and had just heard about the final loss of Calais by the English and was furious about it. He said he'd teach the little toads to go snatching towns from us. But we didn't know at the time that he was referring to the Gaffins. I told him afterwards that all bad feelings between the two nations had died out long ago, and that anyhow the Gaffins were only half French, and he said that it was only the French half of Jackie that he had been hitting. The rest had been buried under the perambulator. If the loss of Calais unloosed such fury in him, I tremble to think what the possible loss of the election might entail. All that happened when he was 8. He's older now and knows better. Children with Hyacinth's temperament don't know better as they grow older. They merely know more. They don't know better as they grow older. They merely know more. Nonsense. He will enjoy the fun of the election, and in any case, he'll be tired out by the time the poll is declared, and the new sailor suit that I've had made for him is just the right shade of blue for our election colors, and it will exactly match the blue of his eyes. He will be a perfectly charming note of color. There is such a thing as letting one's aesthetic sense override one's moral sense, said Mrs. Panstrapon. I believe you would have condoned the South Sea Bubble and the persecution of the Albigenses if they had been carried out in an effective color scheme. However, if anything unfortunate should happen down at Loughbridge, don't say it wasn't foreseen by one member of the family. The election was keenly but decorously contested. The newly appointed colonial secretary was personally popular, while the government to which he adhered was distinctly unpopular, and there was some expectancy that the majority of 400 obtained at the last election would be altogether wiped out. Both sides were hopeful, but neither could feel confident. The children were a great success, The little Jutterlys drove their chubby donkeys solemnly up and down the main streets, displaying posters which advocated the claims of their father on the broad general grounds that he was their father, while as for Hyacinth, his conduct might have served as a model for any seraph child that had strayed unwittingly onto the scene of an electoral contest. Of his own accord, and under the delighted eyes of half a dozen camera operators, he had gone up to the Jutterly children and presented them with a packet of butterscotch. "We needn't be enemies because we're wearing the opposite colors," he said with engaging friendliness, and the occupants of the donkey cart accepted his offering with polite solemnity. The grown-up members of both political camps were delighted at the incident, with the exception of Mrs. Panstrapon, who shuddered. "Never was Clytemnestra's kiss sweeter than on the night she slew me," she quoted, but made the quotation to herself. The last hour of the poll was a period of unremitting labor for both parties. It was generally estimated that not more than a dozen votes separated the candidates, and every effort was made to bring up obstinately wavering electors. It was with a feeling of relaxation and relief that everyone heard the clock strike the hour for the close of the poll. Exclamations broke out from the tired workers, and corks flew out from bottles.
"Well, if we haven't won, we've done our level best. It has been a clean, straight fight, with no rancor. The children were quite a charming feature, weren't they?"
I don't know why I gave that a sort of New England accent. The children, it suddenly occurred to everybody, they had seen nothing of the children for the last hour. What had become of the three little Jutterlys and their donkey cart, and for that matter, what had become of Hyacinth? Hurried, anxious embassies went backwards and forwards between the respective party headquarters and the various committee rooms, but there was blank ignorance everywhere as to the whereabouts of the children. Everyone had been too busy in the closing moments of the poll to bestow a thought on them. Then there came a telephone call at the Unionist Women's Committee Rooms, and the voice of Hyacinth was heard demanding when the poll would be declared.
"Where are you, and where are the Jutterly children?" asked his mother.
"I've just finished having high tea at a pastry cook's," came the answer, "and they let me telephone. I've had a poached egg and a sausage roll and four meringues."
"You'll be ill. Are the little Jutterlys with you?"
"Rather not. They're in a pigsty."
"A pigsty? Why, what pigsty?"
"Near the Crawley Road. I met them driving about a back road and told them that they were to have tea with me and put their donkeys in a yard that I knew of. Then I took them to see an old sow that had got 10 little pigs. I got the sow into the outer sty by giving her bits of bread while the Jutterlys went in to look at the litter. Then I bolted the door and left them there."
"You wicked boy, do you mean to say you've left those poor children there alone in the pigsty?"
"They're not alone. They've got 10 little pigs with them."
"They're jolly well crowded."
"They were pretty mad at being shut in, but not half as mad as the old sow is at being shut out from her young ones. If she gets in while they're there, she'll bite them into mincemeat. I can get them out by letting a short ladder down through the top window, and that's what I'm going to do if we win. If their blighted father gets in, I'm just going to open the door for the sow and let her do what she dashed well likes to them. That's why I want to know when the poll will be declared."
Here the narrator rang off. A wild stampede and a frantic sending off of messengers took place at the other end of the telephone. Nearly all the workers on either side had disappeared to their various club rooms and public house bars to await the declaration of the poll, but enough local information could be secured to determine the scene of Hyacinth's exploit. Mr. John Ball had a stable yard down near the Crawley Road, up a short lane, and his sow was known to have a litter of 10 young ones. Thither went in headlong haste both the candidates, Hyacinth's mother, his aunt, Mrs. Panstrapon, and two or three hurriedly summoned friends. The two Nubian donkeys, contentedly munching on bundles of hay, met their gaze as they entered the yard. The hoarse, savage grunting of an enraged animal and the shriller note of 13 young voices, three of them human, guided them to the sty in the outer yard of which a huge Yorkshire sow kept up a ceaseless, raging patrol before a closed door. Reclining on the broad ledge of an open window, from which point of vantage he could reach down and shoot the bolt of the door, was Hyacinth, his blue sailor suit somewhat the worse for wear, and his angel smile exchanged for a look of
demoniacal determination. "If any of you comes a step nearer," he shouted, "the sow will be inside in half a jiffy." A storm of threatening, arguing, and entreating expostulation broke from the baffled rescue party, but it made no more impression on Hyacinth than the squealing tempest that raged within the sty. "If Jutterly heads the poll, I'm going to let the sow in. I'll teach the blighters to win elections from us."
"He means it," said Mrs. Panstrepon. "I feared the worst when I saw that butterscotch incident."
"It's all right, my little man," said Jutterly, with the duplicity to which even a colonial secretary can sometimes stoop.
That's irony.
"Your father has been elected by a large majority."
"Liar,"
reported Hyacinth with the directness of speech that is not merely excusable, but almost obligatory in the political profession.
More irony.
"The votes aren't counted yet. You owe gammon me to the result either." Gammon me, that's something we wouldn't say nowadays, but obvious, meaning obvious from context. G-A-M-M-O-N.
"You won't gammon me as to the result, either. A boy that I palled with is going to fire a gun when the poll is declared. Two shots if we won, one shot if we haven't."
The situation began to look critical.
"Drug the sow," whispered Hyacinth's father.
Someone went off in a motor to the nearest chemist shop and returned presently with two large pieces of bread, liberally dosed with narcotic. The bread was thrown deftly and unostentatiously into the sty, but Hyacinth saw through the maneuver. He set up a piercing imitation of a small pig in purgatory, and the infuriated mother ramped round and round the sty. The pieces of bread were trampled into the slush. At any moment now, the poll might be declared. Jutterly flew back to the town hall where the votes were being counted. His agent met him with a smile of hope. "You're 11 ahead at present, and only about 80 more to be counted. You're just going to squeak through."
"I mustn't squeak through, though," exclaimed Jutterly hoarsely. "You must object to every doubtful vote on our side that can possibly be disallowed. I must not have the majority."
Then was seen the unprecedented sight of a party agent challenging the votes on his own side with a captiousness that his opponents would have hesitated to display. One or two votes that would certainly have passed muster under ordinary circumstances were disallowed, but even so, Jutterly was still six ahead with only 30 more to be counted. To the watchers by the sty, the moment seemed intolerable. As a last resort, someone had sent for a gun with which to shoot the sow, though Hyacinth would probably draw the bolt the moment such a weapon was brought into the yard. Nearly all the men were away from their homes, however, on election night, and the messenger had evidently gone far afield in his search. It must be a matter of minutes now to the declaration of the poll. A sudden roar of shouting and cheering was heard from the direction of the town hall. Hyacinth's father clutched a pitchfork and prepared to dash into the sty in the forlorn hope of being on time. In time. A shot rang out in the evening air. Hyacinth stooped down from his perch and put his finger on the bolt. The sow pressed furiously against the door. Bang! Came another shot. Hyacinth wriggled back and sent a short ladder down through the window of the inner sty. "Now you can come up, you unclean little blighters," he sang out. "My daddy's got in, not yours. Hurry up, I can't keep the sow waiting much longer. And don't you jolly well come butting into any election again where I'm on the job." In the reaction that set in after the deliverance, furious recriminations were indulged in by the lately opposed candidates, their womenfolk, agents, and party helpers. A recant was demanded, but failed to establish the fact that the colonial secretary had obtained a majority. Altogether, the election left a legacy of soreness behind it, apart from any that was experienced by Hyacinth in person. "It is the last time I shall let him go to an election," exclaimed his mother.
"There I think you are going to extremes," said Mrs. Panstrepon. "If there should be a general election in Mexico, I think you might safely let him go there. But I doubt whether our English politics are suited to the rough and tumble of an angel child."
So there we had the example of a woman actually being smart and right. Something you don't find in every story by Saki. The image of the lost soul. And in my copy, there's an asterisk after that that says, written in 1891, so I suppose this is a little out of time with the others, probably written about 20 years earlier, at least 20 years earlier, maybe closer to 30 years earlier. The image of the lost soul. There were a number of carved stone figures placed at intervals among the parapets of the old cathedral. Some of them represented angels, others kings and bishops, and nearly all were in attitudes of pious exaltation and composure. But one figure, low down on the cold north side of the building, had neither crown, mitre, nor nimbus. The mitre is like a wand, the nimbus is like that halo over their head. And its face was as hard and bitter and downcast. Was hard, bitter, and downcast. So all the figures are angels, but there's one gargoyle type thing, it sounds like. The image of the lost soul. It must be a demon, declared the fat blue pigeons that roosted and sunned themselves all day on the ledges of the parapet. But the old belfry jackdaw, bats in the belfry, well, here's a jackdaw in the belfry, which is a crow, who was an authority on ecclesiastical architecture, I think a jackdaw is a crow, crow-like anyway, said it was a lost soul, and there the matter rested. One autumn day there fluttered onto the cathedral roof a slender, sweet-voiced bird that had wandered away from the bare fields and thinning hedgerows in search of a winter roosting place. It tried to rest its tired feet under the shade of a great angel wing or to nestle in the sculptured folds of a kingly robe, but the fat pigeons hustled it away from wherever it settled, and the noisy sparrow folk drove it off the ledges. No respectable bird sang with so much feeling. They cheeped one to another, and the wanderer had to move on. Well, I'm going to read that again because my heart and my tone were not in it because I was thinking of Led Zeppelin. If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, hedgerow is an English word. You don't see that used apart from your ball. I've only ever seen it used. There are hedgerows like in the no man's land, you know, when they had the trench warfare and the bombed out, muddy, nasty areas. The only thing left standing would be some of the hedgerows, I guess, over in the low Belgium and France. You don't really hear about hedgerows in America, though, at least I've known. You hear about windbreaks at the edge of fields, but that's about it. Anyway, so this bird sang very sweetly, and they're saying, no respectable bird sang with so much feeling, they cheeped one another. And the wanderer had to move on. Only the effigy of the lost soul offered a place of refuge. The pigeons did not consider it safe to perch on, a projection that leaned so much out of the perpendicular and was, besides, too much in the shadow. The figure did not cross its hands in the pious attitude of the other graven dignitaries, but its arms were folded as in defiance, and their angle made a snug resting place for the little bird. Every evening it crept trustfully into its corner against the stone breast of the image, and the darkling eyes seemed to keep watch over its slumbers. The lonely bird grew to love its lonely protector, and during the day it would sit from time to time on some rain chute or other abutment and trill forth its sweetest music in grateful thanks for its nightly shelter. And it may have been the work of wind and weather or some other influence, but the wild drawn face, maybe I should say the wild drawn, like tired or fatigued, face seemed gradually to lose some of its hardness and unhappiness. Every day, through the long monotonous hours, the song of his little guest would come up in snatches to the lonely watcher, and at evening, when the vesper bell was ringing, and the great gray bats slid out of their hiding places in the belfry roof, those would be the bats in the belfry, that's where that originates, the bright-eyed bird would return, twitter a few sleepy notes, and nestle into the arms that were waiting for him. Those were the happy days for the dark image. Only the great bell of the cathedral rang out daily its mocking message. After joy, sorrow. The folk in the verger's lodge, I'm going to look up what verger means because I doesn't know. Don't know how I never came across that before. It means like a church custodian, an official in a church who acts as a caretaker and attendant. Like a guy living in a graveyard or taking care of a lighthouse, while the equivalent in a church is called a verger. Also, a secondary meaning, not to confuse you, but an officer who carries a rod before a bishop or dean as a symbol of office. So I guess that would be one of his attendance duty, but it sounds more like a caretaker, basically, than anything. The folk in the verger's lodge noticed a little brown bird flitting about the cathedral precincts and admired its beautiful singing. But it is a pity, said they, that all that warbling should be lost and wasted far out of hearing up on the parapet. They were poor, but they understood the principles of political economy, so they caught the bird and put it in a little wicker cage outside the lodge door. That night the little songster was missing from its accustomed haunt, and the dark image knew more than ever the bitterness of loneliness. Perhaps his little friend had been killed by a prowling cat or hurt by a stone. Perhaps he had flown elsewhere. But when morning came, there floated up to him, through the noise and bustle of the cathedral world, a faint, heart-aching message from the prisoner in the wicker cage far below. And every day at high noon, when the fat pigeons were stupefied into silence after their midday meal, and the sparrows were washing themselves in the street puddles, the song of the little bird came up to the parapets, a song of hunger and longing and hopelessness, a cry that could never be answered. The pigeons remarked, between meal times, that the figure leaned forward more than ever out of the perpendicular. One day no song came up from the little wicker cage. It was the coldest day of the winter, and the pigeons and sparrows on the cathedral roof looked anxiously on all sides for the scraps of food which they were dependent on in hard weather. "Have the lodge folk thrown out anything on the dust heap?" inquired one pigeon of another, which was peering over the edge of the north parapet. "Only a little dead bird," was the answer. There was a crackling sound in the night on the cathedral roof, and a noise as of falling masonry. The belfry jackdaw said the frost was affecting the fabric, and as he had experienced many frosts, it must have been so. In the morning it was seen that the figure of the lost soul had toppled from its cornice, and lay now in a broken mass on the dust heap outside the verger's lodge. "It is just as well," cooed the fat pigeons after they had peered at the matter for some minutes. "Now we shall have a nice angel put up there. Certainly they will put an angel there." After joy, sorrow, rang the great bell. Reminds me a little of Mark Twain saying that the human body was a machine, is about equal parts pain and pleasure, or that was all you could rationally expect in this life. I don't remember where he said it. Two more. These four this time are slightly shorter, at least 2, 3, and 4 are. The Purple of the Balkan Kings, with an asterisk that says, this and the following tale were written during the Balkan War. God only knows which one that was. The Purple of the Balkan Kings. Luitpold Wolkenstein, financier and diplomat on a small, obtrusive, self-important scale, sat in his favored cafe in the world-wise Habsburg capital, confronted with the Neue Freie Presse, the New Free Press newspaper. Habsburg, remember, they were the Habsburg Catholic Empire there in Central Eastern Europe. A lot of the Habsburgs hated Nazis, gloated about defeating them, but it's neither here nor there. So this self-important Luitpold, L-U-I-T-P-O-L-D, Wolkenstein, sitting there with his cup of his paper and his cup of cream-topped coffee and attendant glass of water that a sleek-headed piccolo had just brought him. For years longer than a dog's lifetime, sleek-headed piccolos had placed the Neue Freie Presse and a cup of cream-topped coffee on his table. For years he had sat at the same spot under the dust-coated stuffed eagle that had once been a living, soaring bird on the Styrian mountains, and was now made monstrous and symbolical with a second head grafted onto its neck and a gilt crown placed on either dusty skull. Today Luitpold Wolkenstein read no more than the first article in his paper, but he read it again and again. Now he mentioned Styrian Mountains. I looked it up. Styria is a state in the southeast of Austria. So again, down towards the Balkan direction. I don't think the Styrians are the Balkans. They're the Styrians. The second largest state in Austria, down in the southeast. Okay. So he's sitting there. And I don't know what the piccolo, well, we know the piccolo is an instrument. I don't know what it means. I didn't know it had a second meaning as a waiter, but I looked up piccolo and I don't see it. So he's going for something there that is beyond me anyway. Where is it? A sleek-headed piccolo. I just brought him. Well, don't know. Now, the article that he's rereading. The Turkish fortress of Kilise, Kirk would be like a castle, has fallen. The Serbs, it is officially announced, have taken Kumanovo. The fortress of Kirk Kilise, K-I-L-I-S-S-E-H, lost. Kumanovo was taken by the Serbs. These are tidings for Constantinople, resembling something out of Shakespeare's Tragedies of the Kings. The neighborhood of Adrianople, and the eastern region, where the great battle is now in progress, will not reveal merely the future of Turkey, but also what position and what influence the Balkan states are to have in the world. For years longer than a dog's lifetime, Luitpold Wolkenstein had disposed of the pretensions and strivings of the Balkan states over the cup of cream-topped coffee that sleek-headed piccolos had brought him. Never traveling farther eastward than the horse fair at Temesvar, never inviting personal risk in an encounter with anything more potentially desperate than a hare or partridge, he had constituted himself the critical appraiser and arbiter of the military and national prowess of the small countries that fringe the dual monarchy on its Danube border. And his judgment had been one of unsparing contempt for small-scale efforts of unquestioning respect for the big battalions and full purses. He's a front runner. He's on the winner. Over the whole scene of the Balkan territories and their troubled histories had loomed the commanding magic of the words, the great powers. Even more imposing in their Teutonic rendering, die Großmächte. Macht, right? Wehrmacht. Then plural, that'd be Mächte, add an umlaut to the A and an E in the N for plural, as is many plurals are made that way in German by adding an E in the N that is not pronounced A as E normally is in German, pronounced U on the end of words. So, Großmacht, great power, Großmächte, A umlaut, but the same spelling, M-A with an umlaut, C-H-T. Großmächte, die Großmächte, D for plural, D-I-E, plural, German, D. Die Großmächte, die Gross powers, the great powers. Even more imposing in their Teutonic rendering, the Großmächte. Worshipping power and force and money mastery as an elderly, nerve-ridden woman might worship youthful physical energy, the comfortable, plump-bodied cafe oracle had jested and jibed at the ambitions of the Balkan kinglets and their peoples. Now, I was the first one to use manlet and modern parlance. Well, this is where people get these ideas by reading you. Oh, you just have to stick lead in the end of something to make it small, the small version, right? Well, if you do that with a lot of words, it comes up with something that is not only new, but funny. That's how writers do it. kinglet. Funny idea, right? And their peoples had unloosed against them that battery of strange lip sounds that a Viennese employs almost as an auxiliary language to express the thoughts when his thoughts are not complimentary. British travelers had visited the Balkan lands and reported high things of the Bulgarians and their future. Russian officers had taken peeps at their army and confessed, "This is a thing to be reckoned with, and it is not we who have created it. They have done it by themselves." But over his cups of coffee and his hour-long games of dominoes, the oracle had laughed and wagged his head and distilled the worldly wisdom of his caste. The Grossmächte had not succeeded in stifling the roll of the war drum. That was true. The big battalions of the Ottoman Empire would have to do some talking, and then the big purses and big threatenings of the powers would speak, and the last word would be with them. In imagination, Leutpold heard the onward tramp of the red-fezzed bayonet-bearers echoing through the Balkan passes, saw the little sheepskin-clad mannequins driven back to their villages. This is another way of manlet mannequins, small men, driven back to their villages. Saw the augustly chiding spokesman of the powers, dictating, adjusting, restoring, settling things once again in their allotted places, sweeping up the dust of conflict. And now his ears had to listen to the war drum rolling in quite another direction, had to listen to the tramp of battalions that were bigger and bolder and better skilled in warcraft than he had deemed possible in that quarter. His eyes had to read in the columns of his accustomed newspaper a warning to the Grossmächte that they had something new to learn, something new to reckon with, much that was time-honored to relinquish. The great powers will have no little difficulty in persuading the Balkan states of the inviolability of the principle that Europe cannot permit any fresh partition of territory in the East without her approval. Even now, while the campaign is still undecided, there are rumors of a project of fiscal unity extending over the entire Balkan lands, and further of a constitutional union in imitation of the German Empire. That is perhaps only a political straw blown by the storm, but it is not possible to dismiss the reflection that the Balkan states, leagued together, command a military strength with which the great powers will have to reckon. The people who have poured out their blood on the battlefields and sacrificed the available armed men of an entire generation in order to encompass a union with their kinsfolk will not remain any longer in an attitude of dependence on the great powers or on Russia, but will go their own ways. The blood that has been poured forth today gives for the first time a genuine tone to the purple of the Balkan kings. The great powers cannot overlook the fact that a people that has tasted victory will not let itself be driven back again within its former limits. Turkey has lost today not only Kirk Kilisse and Kumanovo, but Macedonia also. Just north of Greece. Leutpold Wolkenstein drank his coffee, but the flavor had somehow gone out of it. His world, his pompous, imposing, dictating world, had suddenly rolled up into narrower dimensions. The big purses and the big threats had been pushed unceremoniously on one side. A force that he could not fathom, could not comprehend, had made itself rudely felt. The august Caesars of Mammon and armament had looked down frowningly upon the combat, and those about to die had not saluted, had no intention of saluting. A lesson was being imposed on unwilling learners, a lesson of respect for certain fundamental principles, and it was not the small struggling states who were being taught the lesson. Leutpold Wolkenstein did not wait for the quorum of domino players to arrive. They would all have read the article in the Freie Press, and there are moments when an oracle finds its greatest salvation in withdrawing itself from the area of human questioning. So he's making fun of the typical blustering idiot who disappears when he's wrong, when he thinks of Nancy Grace talking about how, as a prosecutor no less, that is someone in absolute, a prosecutor no less in the South, someone in absolute perfect position to know the lie that was that Duke case, denouncing yet those innocent Duke white young men and not showing up when they were found innocent. That's the parallel that comes to my mind. But he's just making fun of blowhards and ignoramuses and people who think their opinion's always right. And then it's not always right, but they then try to escape their comeuppance. Last story for today will be the cupboard of the yesterdays. The cupboard of the yesterdays. War is a cruelly destructive thing, said the wanderer, dropping his newspaper to the floor and staring reflectively into space. War is a cruelly destructive thing, said the wanderer. Ah, yes, indeed, said the merchant, responding readily to what seemed like a safe platitude. When one thinks of the loss of life and limb, the desolated homesteads, the ruin, I wasn't thinking of anything of the sort, said the wanderer. I was thinking of the tendency that modern war has to destroy and banish the very elements of picturesqueness and excitement that are its chief excuse and charm. It is like a fire that flares up brilliantly for a while and then leaves everything blacker and bleaker than before. After every important war in Southeast Europe in recent times, there's been a shrinking of the area of chronically disturbed territory, a stiffening of frontier lines, an intrusion of civilized monotony. And imagine what may happen at the conclusion of this war if the Turks should really be driven out of Europe. Well, it would be a gain to the cause of good government, I suppose, said the merchant. But have you counted the loss, said the other? The Balkans have long been the last surviving shred of happy hunting ground for the adventurous, a playground for passions that are fast becoming atrophied for want of exercise. In old bygone days, we had the wars in the Low Countries always at our doors, Holland and such. As it were, there was no need to go far afield into malaria-stricken wilds if one wanted a life of boot and saddle and license to kill and be killed. Those who wished to see life had a decent opportunity for seeing death at the same time. It is scarcely right to talk of killing and bloodshed in that way, said the merchant reprovingly. One must remember that all men are brothers. One must also remember that a large percentage of them are younger brothers. Instead of going into bankruptcy, which is the usual tendency of the younger brother nowadays, they gave their families a fair chance of going into mourning. Every bullet finds a billet, according to a rather optimistic proverb, and you must admit that nowadays it is becoming increasingly difficult to find billets for a lot of young gentlemen who would have adorned and probably thoroughly enjoyed one of the old-time happy-go-lucky wars. But that is not exactly the burden of my complaints. The Balkan lands are especially interesting to us in these rapidly moving days because they afford us the last remaining glimpse of a vanishing period of European history. When I was a child, one of the earliest events of the outside world that forced itself coherently under my notice was a war in the Balkans. I remember a sunburnt, soldierly man putting little pin flags on a war map, red flags for the Turkish forces and yellow flags for the Russians. It seemed a magical region with its mountain passes and frozen rivers and grim battlefields, its drifting snows and prowling wolves. There was a great stretch of water that bore the sinister but engaging name of the Black Sea. Nothing that I ever learned before or after in geography lesson made the same impression on me as that strange named inland sea. And I don't think its magic has ever faded out of my imagination. And there was a battle called Plevna that went on and on with varying fortunes for what seemed like a great part of a lifetime. I remember the day of wrath and mourning when the little red flag had to be taken away from Plevna. Like other maturer judges, I was backing the wrong horse, or at any rate the losing horse. And now today we are putting little pin flags again into maps of the Balkan region, and the passions are being turned loose once more in their playground. The war will be localized, said the merchant vaguely. At least everyone hopes so. It couldn't wish for a better locality, said the wanderer. There is a charm about those countries that you find nowhere else in Europe. The charm of uncertainty and landslide and the little dramatic happenings that make all the difference between the ordinary and the desirable.
Life is held very cheap in those parts, said the merchant.
To a certain extent, yes, said the wanderer. I remember a man at Sofia who used to teach me Bulgarian in a rather inefficient manner, interspersed with a lot of quite wearisome gossip. I never knew what his personal history was, but that was only because I didn't listen. He told it to me many times.
After I left Bulgaria, he used to send me Sofia newspapers from time to time. I felt that he would be rather tiresome if I ever went there again. And then I heard afterwards that some men came in one day from heaven knows where, just as things do happen in the Balkans, and murdered him in the open street, and went away as quietly as they had come. You will not understand it, but to me there was something rather piquant in the idea of such a thing happening to such a man. After his dullness and his long-winded small talk, it seemed a sort of brilliant esprit d'escalier on his part, spirit of writing, I think, to meet with an end of such ruthlessly planned and executed violence.
The merchant shook his head at the piquancy of the incident was not within striking distance of his comprehension.
Because the merchant doesn't take sides, he takes money. I should have been shocked at hearing such a thing about anyone I had known, he said.
The present war, continued his companion, without stopping to discuss two hopelessly divergent points of view, may be the beginning of the end of much that has hitherto survived the resistless creeping in of civilization. The Balkan lands are to be finally parceled out between the competing Christian kingdoms and the old haphazard rule of the Turk, banished to beyond the Sea of Marmora. The old order, or disorder, if you like, will have received its death blow. Something of its spirit will linger, perhaps, for a while in the old charmed regions where it bore sway. The Greek villagers will doubtless be restless and turbulent and unhappy where the Bulgars rule, and the Bulgars will certainly be restless and turbulent and unhappy under Greek administration, and the rival flocks of the Exarchate and the Patriarchate will make themselves intensely disagreeable to one another, various forms of orthodoxy. Wherever the opportunity offers, the habits of a lifetime, of several lifetimes, are not laid aside all at once. And the Albanians, of course, we shall have with us still, a troubled Moslem pool left by the receding wave of Islam in Europe. But the old atmosphere will have changed, the glamour will have gone, the dust of formality and bureaucratic neatness will slowly settle down over the time-honored landmarks, the Sanjak of Novi Bazar, the Murstig Agreement, the Komitadya bands, the Vilayet of Adrianople, all those familiar outlandish names and things and places that we have known so long as part and parcel of the Balkan question will have passed away into the cupboard of yesterdays, as completely as the Hansa League and the wars of the guises.
And that's the name of the short story. It's not over, but The Cupboard of the Yesterdays.
They were the heritage that history handed down to us, spoiled and diminished, no doubt, in comparison with yet earlier days that we never knew, but still something to thrill and enliven one little corner of our continent, something to help us conjure up in our imagination the days when the Turk was thundering at the gates of Vienna. And what shall we have to hand down to our children? Think of what their news from the Balkans will be in the course of another 10 or 15 years. Socialist Congress at Yuskob, election riot at Monastir, great dock strike at Salonika, visit of the YMCA to Varna. Varna, on the coast of that enchanted seal, they will drive out to some suburb for tea and write home about it as the Bexhill of the East. War is a wickedly destructive thing.
Still, you must admit, began the merchant.
And that was the wanderer talking. War is a wickedly destructive thing. Still, you must admit, began the merchant, but the wanderer was not in the mood to admit anything. He rose impatiently and walked to where the tape machine was busy with news from Adrianople. And that's the end of that story. So those were some stories about the Balkans today, for the most part.
Anyway, as I said, I'm Alex Litter. I've been reading to you from The Complete Stories of Saki by Hector Hugh Monroe. You can find everything, as always, at viennainforum.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.